Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. Since the dawn of civilization, the greatest monuments created by mankind have been celebrated as wonders of the world. And like the days of the week and deadly sins, there are always seven of them. The wonders of the ancient world included the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Great Pyramid of Giza, and the tremendous Lighthouse of Alexandria. In the centuries that have followed, further lists have been drawn up, recognizing more modern wonders, the Empire State Building in New York, the Great Wall of China. Other Magnificent Sevens salute natural phenomena, such as the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the drummer Nick Mason, CBE, part of one of the all-time great rock bands, Pink Floyd. From the psychedelic 60s onwards, Pink Floyd have been critically and commercially hugely successful in Britain and around the world, creating innovative music and albums such as The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, The Dark Side of the Moon and The Wall, and A Saucer Full of Secrets, the name of their second album and the name of Nick's current band. Pink Floyd's tremendous success was earned in part by their intense songwriting skills, in part by their unsurpassed production values in the studio and in live performances, but of course mainly by the exquisite percussion and drumming skills of Nick Mason himself, the only ever-present member of Pink Floyd, which over the years have sadly known their fair share of personnel changes, splits, divisions, disputes, and indeed deaths. Now, Nick, so far there have been no overlaps or duplications in the wonders chosen by the various guests I've interviewed on this podcast, but you're the first who is another guest's wonder, or anyway, part of it, Omid Jalili having selected Pink Floyd as one of his wonders of the world. How do you enjoy the adulation of being a rock god?
Well, it doesn't, I suppose it doesn't really impinge on my life that much of the time. The interesting thing is that obviously it's being part of a very successful group is one thing, but I'm not a proper, what I'd call a proper pop star, so that I can still go into Sainsbury's without the place turning into mayhem, whereas I'm not so sure that Mick Jagger, should he wish to go into Sainsbury's.
I'm sure he's more of a Waitrose man myself. well, look, in that connection, I want to check out something which I think is now becoming something of an urban myth. And I can't remember if I've ever checked it out with you before, but I remember Frank Skinner telling me a story that he, and the story is spoiled by, you know, discussing it with you, sitting at next to you at dinner, and he's a comedian, obviously, but was doing a bit of music, and you mentioned, oh, you played in the band, and he started to give you advice about where to go to pubs and things, and he said, oh, yeah, I'll put a word in for you. What's your name? Nick. Oh, yeah. What's your band called? And you say, oh, Pink Floyd, and then he's floored by that. But I heard that story being told on the radio just the other day, but Frank Skinner wasn't in it. Somebody else was having this conversation with you. So either lots of people do this with you, or it is Frank Skinner, or it never was Frank. So can you clear that up? Do you recognize that story?
I do completely, and it was Frank Skinner.
Yes.
And, yeah, we did I can't remember the exact conversation, but it ran something like that, that he didn't actually inquire as to which band I was in before giving me order. It was probably some sort of suggestion as to how to handle sort of riders or some contractual issue.
The bit I heard the other day was if it is Frank Skinner, whoever it is in the conversation, asks you, well, do you play in pubs? And you said, yeah, used to.
Yeah, but it didn't go on very long.
But you were obviously nicely stringing him along. But look, as anyone will know who follows music, know you've played around the world and lots of places. So When I came to me asking you for seven wonders of the world, did you have a sort of Rolodex? Would that be the right concept of great places you'd been to or played in that you might have selected for all these wonders or some of these
wonders?
Well,
not really places for wonders. I mean, we have played in a number of exotic places, and I did choose one of them as a wonder.
All right, let's get on to your first wonder then.
Well, I did choose as one of my wonders the city of Venice.
Yes.
But it was not particularly because we'd played there so much as that it's one of the most extraordinary, enduring cities that I could think of. And I still have great affection for it. The fact that we played there was maybe just adds a little extra to it.
Well, let's discuss Venice then, because obviously that could be on a list of wonders, and does feature on several lists of wonders because it is such an extraordinary city. I suppose even people who haven't been there have got a very strong image of it because it is built on I think it's built on islands, but built around canals and on the water, and it's got fantastic architecture. So I assume those are all things that feature in why you've put it on your list of wonders.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, although I'm reasonably well known as a petrol head, the extraordinary thing about it is that it doesn't have any cars, and that's allowed it to remain intact, well, apart from the odd flood, for centuries, literally.
Yes. Well, you mentioned a petrol head. Now, yes, people do know you from your motor vehicle, you know, your love of motor vehicles. Perhaps we'll come on to that later. So why do you think that is a factor in why you've chosen Venice? Because it's just a bit different from traffic and noise and pollution of that sort that you otherwise are involved in.
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt that one of the great attractions of Venice is the atmosphere that's created by the fact that it doesn't have a lot of cars with their engines running and horns going and so on. And it has probably, it must be about the most atmospheric city in the world.
And have you been there a lot, you know, at different times of the year? Because it's obviously a charming place in the summer, except it's very full of tourists and crowds generally in normal times.
Yes, and I have to say most of my visits have been in high seasons. But even so, in fact, the last time I think I was there, we actually went for a gondola ride at about 11 o'clock at night, which was quite extraordinary, and I thoroughly recommend it. Very different to going out during the day.
So this was a romantic gondola, I'm assuming. It depends who you're with, but a romantic gondola.
That could be tricky. No, I was with my wife.
Excellent. You certainly are in this version of events. But of course, you've got to have the income of a rock god to be able to afford a gondola ride, especially at 11 o'clock at night. But maybe that's something that people...
Well, we did have... the gondoliers are slightly still, I think, open-minded about whether Pink Floyd playing in Venice was a good or bad idea. It was quite a remarkable thing. We actually played on a raft moored off St. Mark's Square.
So and when was this? Remind us when that concert was.
That's really challenging. It was about 20 years ago.
And were they worried? Were the gondoliers worried about the loss of business to them, or was Venetians worried that the sound of Pink Floyd might bring down the Campanile again, or what?
Well, opinion was divided. There was certainly some people who thought it was a brilliant idea, other people who thought it might damage the fabric of the buildings, which it definitely didn't do. And then the gondoliers thought that they maybe should ask for extra money and threatened to blow their whistles loudly if we didn't give it to them. But actually, since we were running about sort of 7,000 watts of PA, we weren't too worried about the whistles. And anyway, I think by the end of it, all of them had got rich private audience members to book them. So I think they did pretty well out of it.
Well, I mean, you've played in such an extraordinary large circumstances, but would you rate that performance in Venice as a highlight, or is it the time when you're doing those huge shows, you know, whether it's, you know, in Battersea Power Station or Venice or somewhere in America, were they all big, or was that a fantastic thing to perform in Venice?
It was very special to perform in Venice. I mean, it was very different. But the fact of the matter is that the size of the venue is not necessarily relevant to the quality of it, almost. And in some ways, there's still enormous delight in playing the Half Moon in Putney, actually.
Yes, so as a sort of backup band to Frank Skinner's Ukulele Act or something like that, you'd still get enjoyment out of that.
I'm not here looking for work supporting Frank Skinner, okay?
Well, I mentioned you've started a new band. Perhaps you should just tell us about that. Where do you play with that?
Well, we, funnily enough, we did start at the Half Moon a couple of years ago. And usually some of the nicer rock and roll theatres, the Beacon Theatre in New York, which I really like, and the Olympia in Paris. Basically, it's a band put together with a sort of mixed group of friends who are, I have to say, great musicians. And we're playing very early Pink Floyd catalogue, which is great fun because it's less well-known than some of the Dark Side pieces and the Wall pieces and so on. And it's been really just such fun to go out and play to an audience. I mean, obviously, the last year has been a write-off, but we're hoping we'll eventually get back out on the road.
So you've put together Saucerful of Secrets, and that's an interesting concept to go back and play early stuff of your own band.
Well, yeah, to revisit it and revisit it with different musicians. And they're a wonderfully mixed bunch. There's Lee Harris, who was with the Blockheads, Don Beacon, who was or still is part of The Orb, Guy Pratt, who's worked with just about everyone, but for 30-odd years took over when Roger Waters left. And Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet, who was, I think, a bit of a surprise to a number of people.
But, did you just happen to bump into him, or are you friends? Or?
Yeah. Well, we were friends, and he said he'd really be interested to join in. So, sadly, there were no auditions. I'm fond of saying the only audition would have been for the drummer, but I got the job anyway because it's my band.
And that's you back on the roads. You obviously can't get enough of it. It's not like you're sitting back and just enjoying life from, you know, previous record sales. You still want to be out there banging the drum, literally, for live music.
Well, very sadly, it seems to be that if you haven't grown out of showing off by the time you're about 70, you're probably never going to do it. So, yeah, a happy time is getting out there.
We've got to make some progress through these wonders. Just before we leave Venice, though, obviously Venice is supremely the sort of place which is possibly eating itself in terms of it's such a big draw, such a big tourist attraction for people flying in, people coming in cruise boats. You know, this could apply to lots of places, especially in Italy, that they stop being real places. They become more and more like a Disneyland where it is just a place for... Does that worry you, not as a rock star, but as somebody who likes visiting places in the world? You know, you go to a village...
Yeah. No, I think it is a real worry, and you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not only Venice, it's Florence as well.
Yeah, and every sort of hilltop city and village in Italy, where it used to be a couple of shops that you could buy food in, and if you go there 10 years later, those shops have become tourist shops and you have to go to a supermarket 20 miles away to buy your food. It stopped being the village that you wanted to go and visit. You can't visit the thing you want to visit.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can move now in Tuscany without either coming across a film crew making a movie about living in Italy people farming and growing their own vegetables and then writing books about it.
The city of Venice sets the official hire rate for gondolas at €80 for 30 minutes. But not many people know that same rate, €80, covers six people in the same boat. So if you don't mind sharing, you can split the cost six ways. Ahead of us is one of the most photographed sites in the whole of Venice, the Bridge of Sighs, so called because it was the walkway that condemned men used to leave the city's courts. Nowadays, the only thing to sigh about is the amount of time it'll take you to queue up to get a look inside.
All right, so that's Venice, obviously, very historic place and with notable events in its history, including Pink Floyd performing there. And Don't Look Now, that fantastic film, but and all the history of the churches and St. Mark's and its dominant time. But let's go to somewhere more up to date, really, for your second wonder. I'm vaguely aware of what Apple Park is, but not hugely so. This is built by, created by the Apple Corporation. We're familiar with their computers, their smartphones and so forth. Is it just a corporate headquarters? Is it a corporate town? What is it?
I think you could say it was a corporate city. The way it operates and the number of people who work there. If it was in the UK, it would almost be a small county rather than a town. I mean, I am a fan of Apple products, and I think what they've achieved is quite extraordinary. I mean, it's now a rather frightening operation. But of course, when it started, we all thought it was absolute cutting edge. I mean, it still is cutting edge, but when one looks at early Sinclair computers or whatever, the whole Apple operation is extraordinary.
But it's quite an ecological setup, Apple Park. It's not just concrete. I assume you've been there, have you?
No, not yet. I was invited, in fact, a year and a half ago to go. And of course, with COVID, that all came to a grinding halt. But it's still very much on my wish list.
Well, I assume you could do a concert there, either Sourceful Secrets or, I mean, I've been carefully vague about the tense I've been using about Pink Floyd, because I'm never sure with rock bands whether they've come or they've gone or they're in hiatus or they're definitely in the past. But you could read.
Well, you've explained exactly the status of Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
I wait with interest to find out whether we exist or not at some point in the future.
So if obviously not Steve Jobs, but if somebody at Apple Park said we'd like to have a concert that celebrates some of Apple's values and Pink Floyd would be a perfect band, you might reform or get the band together at any rate.
My bag is already packed. I'm ready to go. It's a matter of just persuading Roger and David to join in.
We'll look forward to that. But you mentioned Apple Park is designed by Norman Foster, and I believe you were taught by Norman Foster.
Well, yes. Rather curiously, before I fell in with a bad lot and ended up in a rock band, I trained as an architect. I did 4.5 years at Regent Street Poly, now more grandly called the University of Westminster. And during that period, they brought in some sort of young guns as part-time lecturers, and they included both Sir Norman Foster and Lord Richard Rogers, which shows that there really is a future in architecture, not just rock and roll. Then over the years, our paths have occasionally crossed, and in particular with Norman, we actually started talking originally about a scheme he was involved in with the V&A, which never really actually took off. But we're now hoping to get on with another project.
You said you studied for 4.5 years to be. I know architecture is quite a long course, but that's quite a lot of study. So you were keen to be an architect.
No, I really enjoyed it, and actually, it's a brilliant training for the music industry, you know, and for what we ended up doing as a band, because it's a lovely mixture of technology and art.
Yeah. And were you all there at the same architectural school?
Three of us were in DA1, Design and Architecture, first year, myself, Roger Waters and Richard Wright.
So how is it that you got distracted this is Pink Floyd 101, but how was it you were distracted so much into rock music that you kissed goodbye to architecture I suppose you presumed forever once you started performing in Oxford Street or in, you know, in the pubs in Putney or wherever.
Not quite. As I say, I fell in with Roger and Rick, and we were persuaded to. We'd all played a little bit before we were at the Poly, and someone asked us if we could play a song they'd written to a publisher. And so we played this song to the publisher, and the publisher said that he thought the song was okay, but he thought the band was truly dreadful. And I think that maybe fired us up a little bit to carry on. Certainly, it's the sort of thing that would sort of get Roger going. And so we started working, really. I had the benefit of a really great year master at the time. I said, I can't keep getting my friends to sign the register while I'm up in Leeds playing at some all-nighter rave. And he said, well, why don't you take a year off? So he sort of invented the gap year a long time before we'd really got there. And so I left ostensibly for a year, and I've just, because he said, well, you know, you can come back on the course, just start this last year again. And sadly, I've never managed to get back there yet.
But it could be open to you. There's an option there if it all goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, as long as I can still get my Zimmer frame up the front steps.
And was it always drums for you? Were you ever tempted into other musical instruments?
No, it was drums. I sort of joined, or a few of us started a band when I was about 13 or 14. And basically, the guy who started it already had a guitar, so that wasn't an option. And I was damned if I was going to be a bass player. So I announced that I would be a drummer. For £7.10, I went to a shop called Foots in Denman Street and bought a kit, which, of course, wasn't a sort of full kit, but it was a pair of bongos and a bass drum and a snare. It wouldn't have really gone anywhere if it hadn't been for the whole sort of rock music, late 60s thing. It was actually seeing Ginger Baker playing with Cream was the moment when I thought, do you know what, that's what I'd like to do.
Well, I was going to mention drummers in that context. I've interviewed Ginger Baker a couple of times and enjoyed it, and of course watched there's a fantastic documentary made about him when he physically assaults the person interviewing him, drawing blood.
That's quite something. If you interview Ginger, he can be really good. But yeah. The documentaries, I have to say, this is a bit of a sort of red herring, but. I thought it was a really good documentary because at the end of the day, you sort of worked out that what he couldn't deal with was people leaving.
Yes.
Whenever they left, he would absolutely go berserk. And as you say, I mean, the actual title of the movie is Beware of Mr. Baker, He Broke My Nose.
That was him
on a good day.
Yes. Well, without straying too much into my experience, I do a program on Radio 4 called Loose Ends, and on one particular episode, I interviewed Sinead O'Connor and Ginger Baker in the one program, and it remains, I got on well with both of them, and I don't have an unblemished track record with rock stars, but that's that was a high point in my interviewing career. But so that Ginger Baker, that you also think of somebody like Keith Moon, those sort of wild men of the drum kit. But then there are other ones, and you perhaps are more of the sort of Charlie Watts, the better behaved, the reliable ones. Is there a sort of drumming school you have to go to? You have to decide which one you're going to be. You're going to be sitting at a drum kit, stoned out of your mind, or drunk, or up all night, going all over the place, or have you got to be the steady one holding the whole thing together, holding the beat together?
Well, yes. I mean, everyone makes a choice as to what they want to do. There's not a committee who've formed to allocate whether you should be a wild man or something a little more temperate.
But anyway, when you got going, the 1960s, there did seem to be something in the air that allowed all sorts of people to come together. I know people still do it, but it was a fantastic time. Perhaps influenced by your third wonder, who is a supreme performer, Bob Dylan. So how did he loom in your thoughts from the word go, or have you just grown to like him, or what?
No, I chose Bob Dylan because I think he is a truly, truly unique talent and did something that really no one else in popular music has ever achieved in terms of a huge output of really sort of important songs. I mean, they work musically, but the lyric content is so much more sophisticated, you know, in bulk than really almost anyone else. There are other great songs and there are other good writers, but nothing on the scale of Bob Dylan.
And were you aware of him from the word go? Because I'm maybe slightly ahead of you in terms of performing, but not much.
I certainly bought the first Dylan album. And we were conscious of the whole thing of him being shouted at for appearing on stage with electric guitars. I think they've even traced now the guy in the audience who shouted Judas.
Yeah, that's in Manchester, wasn't it? In this country. So, well, because he went from an interest in pop music, rock music, to folk music, and then went into back into using electric guitars, electric music. And that's, as you say, he's spanned such a lot of things.
Yeah, I think he really is head and shoulders really above most performers in terms of output. And just moves so easily really between all these sort of genres.
And I'm not quite sure how the world of music works, but have you bumped into him? Have you performed on stage with him? Have you gigged with him?
Met him in passing, I think, more or less. I think what American presidents call a brush past.
And would he acknowledge you or Pink Floyd? Would he say, "Oh yeah, I love you guys," or is he just?
I hope he would, Clive.
Yeah. No, but he comes across sometime. I mean, I'm a big admirer as well, but he's not always the most communicative of people. So I don't know, is he a bit more relaxed with other performers?
Well, obviously, you have a special skill in dealing with tricky people, and. Well, apart from the Bee Gees. And so I look forward to you doing something on Bob.
It's time once again for Theme Time Radio Hour. And today we're going to talk about the endless gray ribbons of asphalt that crisscross this country. We're talking about where the rubber meets the road, all steel. We're going to climb aboard the four-wheeled horseless carriage because today's theme is cars. Automobiles, coupes, race cars, the pickup, the van, jalopies, jeeps, junkers, the station wagon, the roadster, the notchback, the convertible, hardtops, classics, Pontiacs, Cadillacs, Buicks, lowriders, SUVs, and other assorted vehicles. So strap yourself in, put the pedal to the metal, and listen.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So anyway, Bob Dylan earns his right to be in your list of seven wonders. The next one that I have that you've selected, which is less obvious, but interesting nonetheless, is catamarans. Now, why catamarans?
I think it's one of the most interesting things that I've seen in the last, 10, 20 years, is the idea of a sailing boat that can actually travel at something like 40 or 50 miles an hour when there's only 15 knots of wind at that given moment. That is still really quite mysterious.
So how is that? What is it about a catamaran? Catamaran is obviously a double-hulled boat.
Yeah, but it's more to do with this business of the science of how sails work. It's actually the science of aerodynamics, because at one point I'd thought that what I'd choose would be a Formula One car, and in fact just one specific part of it, which is the front wing, which is a remarkable piece of engineering, but does something rather similar in that it takes the passage through the air and makes it work in a way that would have been unthinkable 100 years ago. As I say, this perfect example of how sails can be made to actually induce these sort of speeds from relatively mild winds is probably almost more interesting than some of the other science and technology that's gone, because wind is still such an easy way of finding power.
Well, now you mentioned that you've got a well-known interest in cars, which might have been your wonder, but if we extend the concept of the speed of a catamaran, and you've already touched on this, you obviously do like travelling around at pace. What sort of cars do you do that in?
It's not the speed of the thing. I like the technology and the way it works. I mean, I like motor racing, but I'm happy to race cars that they don't have to be the fastest cars available. It's more about getting the best out of them, I guess, rather than straight line speed, which in itself is not particularly interesting.
But if you use the word race, then that does imply you are trying to go faster than somebody else, or am I getting the wrong end of the stick? You just want to get round the course.
No, you are trying to go faster than somebody else, but it's sort of relative. It can be it's exciting to win a race in a De Chevaux Citroën as it is in something that'll do 240 mile an hour.
But I don't think you race in De Chevaux Citroëns, do you?
No,
Nick?
Not very often, Clive. You're right.
So what okay. sort of, you've got a collection of cars, haven't you?
Yeah.
So what sort of cars are in your collection?
But they're racing cars, from different eras. So that I've got a Bugatti from 1920, and then Maserati from 1950, and then up to cars that I drove at Le Mans in the 80s.
Well, if we just go back to the Bugatti from the 1920s, presumably that's quite a high maintenance, literally a high maintenance thing to have, because if something falls off it or goes wrong, you can't just nip along to Halfords and get a replacement part. You have to presumably have it made by Bugatti or by some workshop that can. So it's a labour of love, I'm imagining.
Yeah, it is. And actually, it's funnily enough, it's not that difficult to get parts made.
Oh, right.
There are dozens of small operators who specialise in complicated bits of old cars. And it's actually one of the nice things. It's sometimes easier to restore a 1920s Bugatti that was hand-built in period than a 1950s Ford Zephyr 6, which was built in a factory with huge machines that have long since been lost and broken up.
And then you've got more recent cars in 1980s vehicles. You drove at Le Mans. So are you taking big risks when you're driving in these sort of events that you drive in? What do you think?
I don't think. I think they're marginally safer than Class A drugs. How about that? It was a sort of concept.
You are not nearly excited enough, because catamarans are awesome. But do you know why they are awesome? Then you would realize how catamarans have far more applications than the classic image of a high-speed vessel. And today, we talk about the unique physics of catamarans and why that makes them great!
All right, we've got your next wonder keeps us in the same sort of area, certainly in terms of speed, because it's Concorde.
Well, I thought that really is one of the extraordinary wonders of the modern world, and has a particular, there's something almost sad about the fact that it's one of those areas where we've sort of, it's been and gone, actually. And people talk about coming back to supersonic aircraft, but it seems less and less likely. I think now the way we're all thinking, Concorde is something that we never will see again. And the funny thing is that it feels still very modern, but there's a generation who never even saw it fly.
Sure. So we better remind them that I think Concorde first flew in 1969, had quite a long berth. It was created by Britain and France cooperating. So that takes us back, obviously.
We won't see that again.
But that wasn't easy in those days. Even how to spell it was a subject of governmental interference. And in the end, it was allowed to have an E on the end so the French could pronounce it the same way as we are going to pronounce it. It was going to be a supersonic, more than twice the speed of sound. So you could halve the time to cross the Atlantic and other long journeys like that. Going to be a huge success. But in the end, I mean, it's in a sense, it's a wonder, but it was a wonder it ever got made, because it was one of those projects that I think it was started to be £70 million it was going to cost to make. And it in the end took £1.3 billion. And they only sold Concordes to British Airways and Air France. And it was economically a complete washout.
And they could really only run it to two or three places, because they couldn't run it over too much land mass with the sonic boom.
So it was too noisy, too expensive, but as you say, fantastically difficult to get it to work, because it was so fast it heated up to an extraordinary extent.
It's quite remarkable, and they would think you were completely mad if you started suggesting it now to any government.
Well, I think the things that worked against it was that it was just as a there were separate developments of larger aircraft that took more people, so that made it much cheaper.
Yeah.
Fuel was going up in price, so it became more expensive. And was there a certain sort of resistance from America that, you know, because this was developed in Europe, they weren't eager to open up their airports to
them? No, that's right. I mean, they could only, they really only got it into New York, didn't they?
Mm. So I think they only made about 20 of them in the end, which for that amount of money. But you obviously you're keen on speed, you're keen on innovation and design and art and science coming together. Did it ever feature in your life? Did you and Pink Floyd zoom across the Atlantic in Concorde from time to time?
Yes, we certainly did. It seemed absolutely obligatory.
So it was Pink Floyd and David Frost and a few rich business people. Was it an enjoyable experience?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. Positively magical. You know, it was a 3-hour trip to New York. We did it a few times when we were touring in America, and I had one occasion where they wanted me to go and do a TV show in America to promote something, and flew me there and back Concorde. I still have the checkbook cover that they give you when you fly Concorde.
Oh, dear, we're going to keep explaining this to younger people. It's Concorde. It's a checkbook. But it's quite nice that you've still got it.
Well, absolutely. It's a very valuable item now, even though I haven't got a checkbook.
The world is about to become a smaller place. Soon you'll be able to travel a mile every 3 seconds. Well over 20 miles in just 1 minute. The Phenomenal Concorde from British Airways. Thank you.
Let's get on to your next wonder, which is cinema. So you've mentioned there was cinematic quality to some of your performances, but presumably this is a wider love of film.
Yeah, I just think when looking for wonders of the modern world, cinema is a pretty broad brush, but it encompasses the amazing journey from early movie cine cameras all the way through to the digital world now. Just extraordinary now what we have to entertain us. I mean, as I say, cinema's a funny word because it sort of takes you back to the 50s and Odeons and all the rest of it. But now we're all glued to our home cinemas and watching the whole series of films night after night. It's extraordinary compared to where we were when I was a kid.
But as far as cinema is concerned, is there a golden age of film that you are attracted to, or are you just champing at the bit to get back into a cinema to see this year's Oscar winners or this year's BAFTA winners?
No, I'm not desperate to get back into the cinema, so I suppose. But I've really enjoyed these sort of series, whether it's something like The Crown. I mean, I think that's the thing that's so impressive, is that this is not Hollywood, but the budget and the expertise absolutely is.
So it's and again, are you drawn to the technicalities of it, the way you're apparently looking at a moving image, but it's made up of lots of single dots, frames strung together or now digitally reconstituted?
No, and it's interesting when you are watching movies now, how old-fashioned old movies now look. The sets on a 50s film are so sort of obvious. It's quite extraordinary the way we now expect a far more sophisticated visual experience.
But there's something of a delight in watching, let's say, an epic film from that era, when you know they have had to assemble 500 people from the locality and dress them up in order to create that effect. Whereas nowadays, they can assemble two people and then digitally rework them all, and it looks like a crowd. It's effective, but just merely knowing that it's easy to do, yes, or easier to do, makes it less satisfying in a way.
I don't think one necessarily chooses between them. You can enjoy both. It's like a black and white movie. I mean, in a way, the black and white movie is a nonsense, but when colour's available. But it's a different experience, I suppose.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy.
We're coming now to your last wonder. And at one stage in preparing for this interview, this discussion, this podcast, you had a provisional list of wonders, which you've pretty much stuck to. But Stonehenge was on your list, and then it's gone off again. And I'm disappointed because I like Stonehenge. I like ancient monuments. And, of course, it would have been an unfair but a handy way of discussing the film This Is Spinal Tap with a member of Pink Floyd. I mean, it's very hard to make any sort of connection between the two, but because the disastrous use of a model of Stonehenge in This Is Spinal Tap. I don't know if that's what you had in mind when you were selecting Stonehenge.
No, it wasn't. I did think that there was an element of a connection there. But I felt that since we were looking for modern wonders, Stonehenge didn't really qualify, but it did seem to have got left out of every other list of ancient monuments.
Yeah.
And it felt that perhaps it was overruled. It was an early form of Brexit and therefore not included, which seemed a shame.
You can do an early form of all sorts of things with Stonehenge. I've made a film about it, a documentary about it recently. It's probably already out of date because something new is always coming along. They're now fairly confident it was built. It was set up actually on a hillside in Wales first, or the big chunk of it, and then and then brought over to the site. So what, and not stolen, not a war, but the people who built it thought, oh, we've got a better site in what's now Wiltshire, but would have been another bit of countryside. What?
The idea of stealing Stonehenge sounds a bit far-fetched.
Well, you know, people immediately say, oh, well, it should be restored to Wales. But of course, it's where it's supposed to be, because that's where the people who built it wanted it to be. And they keep rechanging it and moving around, and it's a burial site. And it was the last flowering of the sort of Stone Age before the people who built it were rather swept away by people with better technology, unfortunately for them. But Stonehenge is not on your list, so we can't discuss Stonehenge. But what is your last wonder?
Oh, well, I decided to put in something sort of practical, and I chose an Indian takeaway, probably a chicken madras, because I thought that is a truly wonderful thing, in that it's just about the only food or meal that can actually genuinely be transported over vast distance and still be as good as when it left the light of Kashmir or whatever, yes. Whatever your local...
Or Kashmir itself.
Okay, quite. because just thinking about it, there's just nothing else that will travel that well.
Yes. No, really? I hadn't realized that was your point about this, but you're absolutely spot on. Virtually all Indian, using a very general term, I think an awful lot of it is made by people who come from Bangladesh, but or any part of that part of the world. Yeah, it all does work. I mean, the one I think always really fails is pizza, a delivered pizza. But I quite like a pizza if I'm 1 minute away from the guy who's made it. But if I'm 20 minutes away from the guy who made it and then the guy on with the scooter to bring it to you, it's all soggy and horrible. And you might as well have made your own bit of bread
Absolutely.
And cheese.
Absolutely. I've no idea why people think pizza's a great sort of takeout meals. And nothing from any of the great sort of Michelin chefs travels particularly well. But you really could. It's a pity the airlines don't take it more seriously, because it's ideal airline food, of course, as well.
Oh, of course. Oh, now I get it. Your ideal journey is on Concorde with chicken madras, or I'd go for chicken tikka or chicken, tandoori chicken, but it's a different part of the Indian subcontinent. But that also does pretty well, I'd say. It's sometimes said to be our national dish, a British national dish, and it's not always clear how much of what we call Indian food was actually developed in India and how much has just been developed by people here to try and work out what British people want to eat. There's a dispute about all those various things.
Yes, there are lots of stories about dishes that were made up on the spot. Chicken tikka masala, I think, is the one particularly is believed not to exist outside the UK.
Yeah, I there's a story, I think the hairy bikers dug up that it was the person giving this evidence, as it were, said it was his father who was somebody came in demanding a bit of sauce in their Glasgow restaurant, and he said, "All right, well, I'll stick that. If you think the chicken tikka's too dry, I'll shove it in some tomato soup and a few herbs in," and he gave it a name, and that's alleged to be the origin of that dish.
Yeah.
But if it's not that, it's certainly something like that must have occurred to try and appeal to late night diners in British restaurants, who aren't always the politest of people, I suppose.
India, the Maharaja's table laden with dozens of dishes. A little lamb biryani, Saab? Or how about a delicate spinach curry or pork vindaloo? This rare gathering of princes and princesses would be surprised to learn just how much the world has been influenced by their cooking.
Well, that's a suitably high point to come to a climax to your wonders of the world, Nick. What I have to do is to come up with the wonder of wonders. What is the of all the things you have come up with? And it's a difficult choice to make, really. It always is, but I think what will be satisfying, since as I've been talking to somebody, a member of such an important band. I think your wonder of wonders, I think it's charming that you've selected somebody else from the music industry. So I think I'll make Bob Dylan your wonder of wonders.
Very good.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Nick Mason, for your seven wonders, your wonder of wonders being Bob Dylan. Nick Mason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is a Stakhanov production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.